I got a cousin who's a Gideon. Really? I said. What's their angle? Spreading the word of Christ. You know what their business model looks like? Steve pulled the curtains closed. They pay for the Bibles with donations. That's all I know. It's just, I've never seen a Gideon church, I said. I'd always wondered if Gideon's even existed. My cousin exists, Steve said. She lives in Cleveland. Barack peered out from the bathroom. Did anyone check the bed? I checked under the bed, I said. You actually want me to check the sheets? We're looking for anything Finn may have left behind. But the sheets? Anything, Barack said. I shuddered. At least Barack was taking the bathroom. I didn't want to think about what sad state it was in, but I could guess I'd been inside cleaner porta-potties at political rallies. The bedspread was pulled all the way up, with nice and tight corners, the way Jill made the bed. I pinched the top corner of the bedspread like I was picking up a dirty diaper and slowly peeled it back. I don't know what I expected to find. Blood, a bullet hole, maybe a dirty diaper. All of the above. Fortunately, all I found was a bleached white sheet. Not that it made me feel any better about the room. It was no place to pass an hour, let alone the final months of your life. Damn it, Finn, if only you'd told me. Barack made his way out of the bathroom. He shook his head. It was worth a shot, I said, collapsing into the chair. To me, it was undeniable now that Finn had been part of something larger. We had nothing concrete to prove it to the cops, but there was at least one person sniffing around his trail. Possibly more, if the burglary and the break-in at the motel were two different parties. Two different criminals. Not to mention the hophead in Darlene's room. At the very least, Finn had been involved with the wrong sorts of people. At the worst, he'd been the wrong sort of people. Could he have been a criminal himself? And what mattered more, the truth or preserving Finn's name? I'd promised Grace Donnelly that I'd find out what happened to her father. I hadn't said what I'd do with that information once I found it. The chair has been moved. I glanced up at Barack. What did you say? The chair, he said, pointing to where I was sitting, has been moved. He crossed the room and knelt down. He ran a hand over the carpet. Recently, too. There are still indents here. I raised myself out of the chair with only minimal wincing. The last thing I wanted was to worry Barack. He didn't know how bad my knee was, and I intended to keep it that way. I bent down to tip the chair to see if there was something hidden underneath it, but Barack and Steve stepped in to do the heavy lifting. Let us young bucks do it, Joe, Barack said. They rolled it onto its back. There was a 12-by-12-inch section of carpet missing. The edges were frayed, as if it had been cut up with a serrated knife. The bare plywood was showing. There was a faint pink stain in the center. My heart was beating fast, propelled by equal parts terror and excitement. None of us spoke. Chapter 16. I left a message on Lieutenant Esposito's voicemail, letting her know we needed to talk ASAP. Since it was past 9 o'clock, I wasn't sure if we would hear from her until morning. Police had to sleep sometime, one assumed. No luck, Barack said, reading the expression on my face. I shook my head. No answer. Steve joined us in the car, after returning the key to the front desk. The night clerk didn't have a clue about the mysterious woman. Not surprisingly, the unhelpful gentleman also claimed ignorance when asked about the missing square of carpet. He thought someone might have taken it as a souvenir. I laughed. The only souvenirs people take home from places like this are bedbugs. I guess we're done here then, Steve said. We're waiting for Esposito's call, I said. A few minutes, Barack said, much to Steve's obvious distress. We can wait a few minutes. I nodded toward the room. What do you think happened in there? Somebody spilled something on the carpet, Steve said. I glared at him in the rearview mirror. No crap, Matlock. Cool down, you guys, Barack said. Steve's right. All we know for sure is that something was spilled on the carpet. Blood, I said. We don't know that, Joe. Would you go to all that trouble to cover up a ketchup stain? No, you wouldn't. The woman wasn't in there long enough to cut the carpet up and move the chair, so we can forget about her for the moment. If there's even a chance that's Finn's blood in there... I had the scenario all worked out in my head already. There was something Detective Capriotti had said the other day that kept coming back to me. He may have even been dead already. I'd done a little Googling and found that rigor mortis takes up to 2 hours to set in. Medical examiners can't determine the exact time of death. All they can give you is an approximate time frame. Being hit by a train would almost certainly muddy the waters further. If the faint pink stain on the plywood was indeed Finn's blood, it was possible that Finn hadn't died of a heart attack or an overdose or even suicide. He could have been murdered. I picked my phone up. No calls. I would have heard it ring, but sometimes missed calls show up that don't ring, for whatever reason. Something happened in that room, I said. Something awful. Even if it has nothing to do with Finn, the cops need to take a look. Steve leaned between the seats. Maybe it's the police who ripped up the carpet. Did you think of that? Maybe they took it to test whatever was on there, and left it out of the case file? If it was a dead end, sure. I swallowed hard. I was searching for a comeback, but he had a point. I'd gone so far down one road that I hadn't stopped to examine any other possibilities. You may have a point, I squeaked. I can't hear you, Steve said. I said it's possible, okay? Barack stuck a hand between us. No need to raise your voice, Joe. We can all hear you just fine. I placed both hands on the wheel to calm myself. Steve's right. I'm sure the police have already checked all of this out. When Esposito calls back, it'll be to chew me a new asshole. And you know what? She'd be within her rights to do that. I'm a grown man. I can take it. But damn it, something's not right. Something stinks to high hell. Barack placed a hand on my shoulder. I understand you're frustrated, Joe, but we've already gone above and beyond. When you talk to the lieutenant, tell her about the woman we saw. Tell her about the missing carpet. If she's as good as everyone says she is, she'll do the right thing and put more detectives on this investigation. She'll connect the dots. If we'd had our heads screwed on straight, we could have caught that woman red-handed. Instead, say we realized she had broken into the room, Barack said. What difference would it have really made? We couldn't have held her against her will. Steve could have. Isn't that right, Steve? He cleared his throat. Technically, you're correct. If we witness a crime in progress, service agents are allowed to make an arrest without a warrant. See? I tapped Barack on the arm. But I left my handcuffs in the little beast, Steve continued. Speaking of which, we shouldn't leave her at the Walmart for too long. Renaissance won't be happy if anything happens to her baby. I glanced at Barack. Renaissance was Michelle's service code name. I thought the car was yours. He didn't look at me. The little beast is insured by that tiny Australian gecko, he said, holding his thumb and index finger a couple inches apart for Steve. She'll be fine. It's a British gecko, I said. Barack and Steve both stared at me. The insurance company mascot, I said. He's British, not Australian. Barack rubbed the fatigue from his eyes. I just don't know about you sometimes, Joe. I just don't know. I stuck my keys in the ignition. Besides my Challenger, there were only 3 cars and a pickup in the parking lot. Either the motel wasn't doing much business tonight, or most of its clientele arrived on foot. A hot pillow joint like this, I guess the latter. Suddenly a thought hit me, like I'd just stuck a fork in a socket. What happened to Finn's car? I asked Barack. The Wilmington PD found it here in the lot. The report doesn't say anything more than that. Could be in the impound. But Finn hasn't been formally suspected of a crime. The car wouldn't be evidence. Then it'd be towed, Barack said, pointing to the sign on the light pole closest to my car. Warning, it read, unauthorized vehicles will be towed. Eventually, I said. It'd be towed eventually. You don't think? I nodded. If his family didn't pick it up, Finn's car could still be here. Unfortunately, neither Barack nor I had any idea what Finn's car looked like. Steve checked with the front desk, but they said they didn't record license plates. The reason was easy to guess. It provided plausible deniability for any number of law enforcement requests, such as this one. If Lieutenant Esposito ever returned my call, I could ask if she had Finn's license plate number handy. Steve offered to have one of his pals at service headquarters do a record search, but I was worried about raising flags. We paced the lot. Barack had his hand on his chin, trying to get his gray matter to work overtime. I never picked up the hand on the chin trick. Whenever I tried, I didn't look like I was thinking. I just looked confused. The pickup isn't his, I said. We can cross that off the list. You're sure? Barack asked. He lived in Riverside. That area's 90% black. He wouldn't last long with that Confederate flag on his license plate. Cross it off the list. And that one, that's a Virginia plate, I said, pointing to a newer Mini Cooper. I don't see him as having registered with the Virginia DMV, unless he was leading some sort of double life. Plenty of addicts lead double lives, but most addicts don't register their cars in other states for the fun of it. So Occam's razor says it's not his car, Barack said. Occam? William of Occam, he said, an English philosopher who had a theory that the simplest answer was usually the correct one. I nodded. I vaguely remembered the term from my law school days, but only vaguely. These eliminations left just two cars, both with dark blue plates proclaiming Delaware the first state. One was a Buick Century, the other a Chevy Impala. Both looked to be from the last century. The last century. Of course. I walked around back of the cars and examined their bumpers. Found it, I said, patting the Buick Century on the trunk. Ridin' with Biden, Barack said, reading the faded bumper sticker. Cute. The driver's side door was locked. I peered into the backseat window. It was a mess of plastic to-go bags and empty styrofoam cups. Looks like he's been living out of his car. Looks like your car, actually, Barack said, peering into the front driver's side window. Looks like someone beat us here, too. He reached for the passenger side door and opened it. Maybe he left it unlocked. Barack ran a finger over the rim of the window, stopping at a scratch in the glass. Someone jimmied the door. That's why it was unlocked. Not a clean job, though. A professional wouldn't have left marks like this. I examined the scratches. How do you know so much about jimmying car locks? You've never locked your keys in your car. That's what a towing company is for, I said. If you can afford AAA, Barack said. If you're a high schooler and you've spent all your money on Al Green records and six-packs, you've got to rely on other means, like friends who boost cars. I shook my head. We'd had very different adolescences, to say the least. I popped the button for the trunk. While Barack searched in back, I checked out the glove compartment. I still didn't know what we were looking for, but the glove compartment was a bust. I found the car's registration and a yellowed manual that hadn't been cracked open since the Reagan administration, but no insurance card. Finn must have kept it in his wallet. I felt underneath the seats. Nothing there but used napkins. I sighed. I hadn't been expecting to find a handwritten manifesto, but I'd hoped there'd be something. A secret laptop that he hadn't told anyone about, with files that showed what he was really up to. Anything to shed light on the mystery that his life had become. Barack slammed the trunk shut, then knocked on the back window. I reached over and popped the lock. They don't make back seats like this anymore, he said, sliding in. They sure don't. Back seats were where action was back in the day. There was one car, the Chevy I'd gotten for my 16th birthday, with a back seat as big as a king-size bed. I'd had big intentions of putting it to use, but I was too timid around girls to be much of a Romeo in high school. The first time I'd gotten intimate in a car wasn't until several decades later, during the 88 campaign. Jill and I were in the parking lot of the Iowa State Fair, waiting on my Secret Service detail. I kissed my beautiful bride on the lips, and she kissed back with a little tongue. Before we knew it, we were rounding first base in the back seat of a rental car, while my personal aide kept tapping on the window to get our attention. I got called out at second. "How can someone live like this?" Barack asked. He was pawing through the trash on the floor behind me. "Sometimes you just forget to clean out your car," I said. "It's not a top priority for most people." "Maybe you should make it a priority." "Me?" "Yes, you," Barack said. "It took me 20 minutes to clean out your car just so Steve would have a place to sit. I don't even want to think about what happens when you hit the road, windows open, and all that trash just starts flying up into the air. You're liable to cause an accident, driving around like that." I hadn't taken the car out all summer. The garbage in the back was from the days I'd been going to the University of Pennsylvania campus for the spring semester, and it had always been raining. I didn't say any of this, though, because it wasn't any of Barack's business. "Sorry that I don't have the Secret Service to vacuum my car out like some people," I mumbled. Barack went around to the passenger side. "You know, Joe." "What?" I said, daring him, taunting him to do his worst, to say something that couldn't be taken back. To say what he really thought of me, for once to speak what was truly on his mind. "I think we're onto something here." Barack held up a styrofoam cup with a Waffle Depot logo. "What does this look like to you?" A coffee cup? There's a dozen of these bad boys, he said, along with a bunch of to-go bags. Looks like before work, he would stop at the Waffle Depot for coffee and maybe a bite to eat. I thought this over. Finn's shift began in the early morning, before the sun was up. There weren't many early-hour diners between the motel and Wilmington Station. There was, however, a Waffle Depot. Do you think he went there the day of the accident? I asked. Barack held up a receipt. I know he went there the day before, at least. Says here his server was named Tina. Maybe he said something. Maybe he was acting funny. I paused. We could swing by just for a bite. I haven't had anything since lunch. I'm so hungry I could eat the balls off a low-flying goose. Barack started to say something, then stopped. Hey, Steve, he shouted across the lot. You like waffles? Chapter 17. Except for the waitress and cook, the Waffle Depot was deserted. We sat in a booth in the far corner. All three of us had sunglasses on, both to disguise ourselves and to protect our eyes from the fluorescent lighting that lit the room like John Boehner's tanning bed. Our caps were pulled low. Are you sticking your gut out on purpose? Barack said. Are you talking to me? I asked. I wasn't talking to Steve. Steve has 1% body fat. Isn't that right, Steve? 0.5%, he said. Is that healthy? I asked. Barack shrugged. The 44th president was in pristine shape as well, not 0.5% body fat, but close enough for government work. He'd been out in the world kayaking, parachuting, and probably kickboxing in underground fight clubs. Meanwhile, I'd been at home, staring at the rowing machine in the basement and occasionally hopping on the treadmill. Steve yawned. There were dark circles under his eyes. Our waitress, a short woman with dark hair and a pierced nose, stopped by to take our orders. Her name, according to her name tag, Tina. She poured a coffee for Steve. Barack and I stuck with water. Just before she turned, Barack told her she looked familiar. You work the graveyard shift, right? I think I've seen you closer to breakfast before. Must be some long nights. She smiled. I thought I recognized you from somewhere. Not from here, but from... Well, I shouldn't even say it out loud. It's kind of ridiculous. You just look like someone famous, that's all. Barack Obama? He said with a smirk. You must hear that all the time. She stepped back and sized him up. He's a little younger than you, though. Barack's smirk dropped. Maybe you can help me out. There was a guy in here Tuesday morning, eating by himself. A white guy with white hair, a little taller than my friend here. That ring any bells? She shook her head. I was busy from start to finish. It was all a blur. There was a wrestling show in town. Those guys have big appetites. Triple, quadruple omelets. One of them destroyed the men's toilet. Just destroyed it. Which wrestler was it? I asked. Barack glared at me. Anyway, I said, the guy that was in here, he comes here all the time. He's a conductor for Amtrak. Oh, she said, Finn. Always sits at the counter, always orders decaf. Her face dropped. Y'all cops or something? I realized that, yeah, we probably did look like cops. Three guys with short hair and sunglasses, two of us in suits. Me in the Aloha shirt looking an awful lot like Magnum P.I. Only thing missing was the mustache. Something like that, I said. Is Finn in some kind of trouble? Barack and I looked at each other. She hadn't heard about the accident. There was an incident, he said. The railroad sent us. We're just talking to people. Nothing formal. I get it. You want to know if I could smell alcohol in his breath, or if he smelled like reefer? She leaned down. Half the people who come in on my shift are coming here straight from the bars, even worse on a Friday or Saturday night. Except tonight, I pointed out. It's still early, she said. The bars don't close till 2. We all looked up at the clock. It was only 10:30. It felt much, much later. But Finn, she continued, I would have noticed if there was anything funny about him. He can't walk around in a uniform smelling like liquor. It'd be like a pilot walking onto a plane with a bottle of Jack Daniels. People tend to notice those sorts of things. So what do you remember about him, Tuesday morning? Did he seem nervous? Brock asked. Tina shrugged. Everybody's a little squirrely these days, ain't they? I think we all got a little ADHD. Her eyes went to Steve, who was checking his pulse again. Barack asked if she'd seen Finn Wednesday morning, too, but she hadn't. just the morning before the accident. I asked. You didn't happen to see him with a bag of... Barack kicked me hard under the table. I wasn't going to say heroin, I whispered through my teeth, though I don't think Barack or anyone heard me. He did have a bag, Tina said. Now that you mention it, yeah, it was a black bag, you know, like for the gym. A duffel bag? That's right. He usually didn't bring nothing in, but that night he had this black duffel bag. Kept it real close by, too. Kind of strange, if you ask me. He could have just left it in his car. In this neighborhood? I asked. What's wrong with this neighborhood? Nothing, I said quickly. Nothing at all. As soon as she left us, I turned excitedly to Barack. A duffel bag. That's something, right? It's not nothing. That doesn't, in and of itself, necessarily mean it's something. I pulled out my phone to call Esposito, but Barack told me to hold up. The lieutenant hasn't called back. If she does call us, then we can ask her if they found a duffel bag near the tracks or at the motel. Until then, there's no point. If you call someone and leave a message, you wait for them to call you back. You don't keep calling and calling and calling and leaving more messages. He paused, then added pointedly, unless your goal is to annoy them. Steve wasn't listening to us bicker. He was in another reality completely, a reality that I wished I could slip into. Our waitress brought out our orders. Barack and Steve had both ordered grilled chicken breasts. They weren't looking at their plates, however. They were staring in horror at my plate as I reached for the bottle of Heinz 57. Are there even hash browns under that mess? Barack asked. I'm pretty sure, I said. My hash browns were, in the parlance of Waffle Depot, hot and bothered. That is, covered with cheese, onion, diced ham, and jalapeno. 740 calories, all gristle and grease. This was what I'd been doing to myself for months now. Jill had caught me more than once eating Ben and Jerry's straight out of the pint, in my boxers and undershirt, in the middle of the night. I only had the foggiest of memories of even getting out of bed. It wasn't sleepwalking, but it was something close to it. How can you eat all those carbs? Steve said. It was good to see him slip back into our realm and make conversation, even if he was being a little snot. Calories are good for you, I said, between massive bites. They give you energy. Caffeine gives you energy. I looked into his eyes, half shaded by drooping eyelids, and then down at his coffee cup, which he'd just emptied for the third time in under 20 minutes. And how's that working out for you? He didn't say anything. While we were waiting for the check in silence, Steve stared deep into what was left of my shredded potatoes, like he was looking at a Van Gogh. I was seriously beginning to worry about his state of mind. Could we trust him with his weapon? You're hungry, I told him. Have the rest of my hash browns. A couple of extra calories isn't going to hurt you. He picked up a fork and stuck it into the mess on my plate, tentatively, like he was poking a dead animal with a stick. He took one bite, and then another. Before I could tell him to slow down, the plate was empty. He even licked it clean. He seemed to spring to life afterward, but it didn't take a psychologist to know he was being eaten alive by guilt. He was an impressive physical specimen, I give him that. If swearing off carbs and being constantly run down was the cost, though, I wasn't sure the trade-off would be worth it. Us old fogies need a little padding. Otherwise, our skin begins to hang in folds over our curtain-rod bones. Barack noticed the dour look on my face. We'll get to the bottom of this thing. Don't worry. There's no way you can guarantee that, I said. I didn't guarantee it. I just have faith. Here comes the hopey changey stuff, I said, affecting my best rural Alaskan accent. Don't go negative on me, Joe. We need to be realistic. What are we doing? What are we really doing here? Right now, I'm visiting the little boy's room, Barack said, sliding out of the booth. I was about to say I'd go with him, but Steve was already on his feet before I could get a word out. I was left there, my mouth hanging open like a schmuck. What's that, Joe? Barack asked, straightening his suit jacket. Never mind, I muttered. Chapter 18 Barack picked up the tab, and I didn't argue. Afterward, we paused on the sidewalk outside the Waffle Depot. Mayflies started dive-bombing us from the fluorescent lights overhead. We tried swatting them away, but they had the numbers advantage. I wasn't ready to get in the car yet, though. Not until we charted a new plan of action. Barack, chewing a post-meal Nicorette, had a different idea. "It's time to call it a night," he said. "You think the bad guys are going to call it a night?" "The bad guys? What else would you call them? We've got people breaking into houses, into motels, into nursing homes, for God's sake." "They could all be part of one organization. Law enforcement, the mob, the Secret Service," Barack said, winking at Steve. Steve did not wink back. "Let's go through what we have so far," Barack continued. "We have a man on the tracks killed by an oncoming train. He has heroin in his pocket. We've got a missing square of carpet in his room. There's a duffel bag, which could be in evidence or even picked up by his family, for all we know. Is that it?" "From everyone I've talked to, he didn't get high," I said. "I'm not ruling it out, I'm just saying I don't buy it. And we don't know for sure if he was killed by the train. He could have been dead already." "An overdose or a heart attack," Barack said. "Or..." "Oh, for cripe's sake," Steve said under his breath. "Here it comes." "You can't tell me foul play's not a possibility," I said. Steve looked at Barack. "Permission to speak freely, sir." "You don't need my permission." Steve took a deep breath. "Okay. I think this has gone far enough. I was willing to indulge this little fantasy of playing detective, but that was before you disregarded my instructions and dove raw dog into that motel room." "There was a woman," I said. "A woman who may have been a transient, or a prostitute, or maybe a drug user looking for a place to shoot up. She may have been armed, in which case you both could be on gurneys right now, or worse, on your way to the morgue. I can't guarantee your safety, Mr. President, if you continue on this absurd quest." Steve was breathing heavy. "Is this the carbs talking?" Barack asked. Steve ignored him. He was on a roll. "If a torn-up patch of carpet is evidence of anything other than a spilled glass of red wine, I'll be surprised. Very surprised." "That's not the sort of place you'd expect to find a wine drinker," I said. "You have to admit that." Steve shot me a look of pure disbelief. "You're hung up on this, aren't you? Say it. Just say it. Murder. You think someone killed him?" "I didn't say that. But it's one possibility. It's a possibility no one else has looked at, as far as I know." "You know why? Because no one else has time for this nonsense. You have zero evidence of foul play. Bad things happen. Burglars break into houses. They break into motel rooms. People spill drinks. And you know what it all means? Nothing." I could feel my temperature rising. Steve knew exactly what buttons to push. Barack must have noticed I was about to blow because he stepped between us. "This Lieutenant Esposito seems quite capable," Steve said. "She was in the National Guard, served in Afghanistan. I don't have any reason not to trust her judgment." He pointed a finger at my chest. "You, on the other hand, I'm just some old bag of bones who's seen too many episodes of Law and Order." Barack threw up his hands to prevent us from going at each other. "That's enough. Steve's right. We need to call it a day. We're not done, though. Tomorrow's a new day. If the lieutenant gives us a hard time, we'll follow the leads wherever they take us. Finn was Joe's friend, and Joe is my friend. We don't abandon our friends just because the going gets rough. If that bothers you, Steve, perhaps you'd feel better if you were reassigned," he paused, "to Bo. I'd rather scoop up dog shit than clean up whatever mess you two make out of this investigation. If anything happens to you, if you trip and skin your knee, that's a black mark on my record. It could mean another year in the ex-presidential protection detail." Steve was sweating like a sinner in church, but he couldn't stop. "Plus, what do you think Renaissance would say if she found out you were playing Sherlock?" "She wouldn't say anything," Barack said sternly, "about something she doesn't know about. You don't report to her, you report to your supervisor. Tell him whatever you need to, but we're not going to discuss any of this with Mrs. Obama. Got that? If she asks, she won't. But if she does, correct me if I'm wrong, but your agency's motto is, worthy of trust and confidence," Barack said. "I'm not asking you to cover for me while I sneak Marilyn Monroe in the back door of the White House. I'm just asking for a little discretion, a little trust." Steve started to object, but then grabbed his side. "You okay, Steve?" I asked. Steve put his other hand in front of his mouth. Before our eyes, his skin went pale and clammy. It looked like he was trying to contain Mount Vesuvius. "The hash browns," Steve croaked out. "How you feeling, Joe?" Barack said. Before I could answer, Steve doubled over and hurled onto the sidewalk. Wet chunks splattered Barack's slacks. Barack and I both looked away. A man and a woman were on their way into the restaurant, and Barack gave them a little wave. They picked up their pace. When the awful, retching noises finally stopped, we both turned to see if Steve was alive or dead. The Secret Service agent was wiping his mouth with the sleeve of his black jacket. He was mostly alive. "Why don't you go clean up?" Barack said. "Can't leave you here alone. Have to stay within arm's length." "Forget whatever they tell you in training," I said. "I say you're not getting in my car smelling like a Jersey sewer rat." Steve made another uncomfortable gurgling noise. He dashed inside, leaving us on the sidewalk beside the puddle of upchuck. "What a wet blanket," I said. "He can't even handle his hash browns. They're greasy, but come on. He's a good guy, but he's a third wheel, a classic third wheel." I had a thought. It was a pretty wild idea, but Steve was on the verge of blowing our entire operation. "I can't work with this guy looking over my shoulder," I told Barack, telling me to be careful all the time. "We're playing things safe, and all we've got so far is a fistful of nothing." Barack smiled slyly. He knew where I was going. It was the same place he was going. "You're a horrible person, Joe. A horrible, horrible person." "What does the bro code say about leaving a wounded man behind?" "I don't know," I said. "What does it say?" "I don't know either. I'm not even sure the bro code exists. But if it did, it would say if we're in pursuit of the greater good, we're well within our rights to drop any dead weight that's dragging us down." We went back inside to the men's room, where we found Steve praying to the porcelain god. Barack slipped $200 bills in Steve's pocket so that he could catch a ride back to the Walmart parking lot. My heart was a flutter as we stepped outside. I couldn't believe we were ditching Barack's detail. It was a dangerous world, especially for politicians in the public eye, especially for presidents, especially for Barack, who had received more death threats than any other president in history. So many plots against him had been foiled, more than the public would ever know, more than I would ever know. Half those whack jobs probably thought he was still the president, or running some sort of deep state operation behind the scenes. I wasn't hip to all the latest ramblings of the black helicopter crowd, but there was one conspiracy theory that said Barack and I were both lizard people, half-alien, half-human hybrids, who'd infiltrated society and were secretly controlling the government. We were behind everything, terrorist attacks, natural disasters, even the interest rate. It was a comforting thought that someone was in control of this chaotic world. I didn't think I'd look very good with a tail, though. "Let's go back to my place," I said, unlocking my door. "We have a guest room. It's made up like a ski lodge. There's a pair of skis and everything." Barack stared at me over the top of the car. "That would be the first place Steve would look. We'd be busted before we even got to sleep." "Fine. How about my vacation house on Rehoboth Beach? That's the second place Steve would look," Barack said. "We need to brainstorm on this. What's the last place Steve would look?" I didn't need to think long on this one. "Zap bam bingo, I've got it." "Don't say my house. Please don't say my house." I shook my head. "I've got something even better." Chapter 19. We were dropped off at the Heart of Wilmington Motel by a taxi, which I paid for with cash. I wasn't happy about leaving my Challenger at the Waffle Depot. If Steve put out an APB for my car, however, we'd be nabbed just like that. After the taxi peeled out, I turned and saw the sign. No vacancy. "You've got to be kidding me," I said under my breath. There were only 11 cars in the lot, including Finn's. Barack slapped me on the back. "This type of motel, all we have to do is wait. Something will open up within the hour." I dragged my feet to the front desk. Barack wasn't wrong, however. Within 20 minutes, a room opened up. I paid in cash. The clerk didn't ask for ID. He didn't even ask for a name. The first thing I noticed when we entered our room was that one of the beds was missing. Or rather, there were two beds, but only one of them had a mattress. "Did you book the honeymoon suite?" Barack asked. "It's not funny," I said. I was tired and cranky and didn't want to deal with a missing mattress. "I'll call the front desk and get it straightened out," Barack said. "You can use the shower first." I hit the bathroom and undressed. Under the harsh lights, my knee looked pretty gruesome, Black and blue and swollen like a bloated corpse. How was I going to explain it to Jill? The best thing would be to do what I always did, tell her the truth, and do a little old-fashioned Catholic groveling for forgiveness. And if my knee was gruesome, my face was an absolute horror show. The circles under my eyes, the creases on my forehead, the weight of the world was on my shoulders, and finally I was starting to slump. What was I doing? Barack might have been in his prime, but I was past mine. No matter how loudly I proclaimed on stage to anyone who would listen that I was in perfect health, I couldn't ignore the effects of Father Time. I was starting to feel my age. It wasn't something I would ever admit aloud to another human being, not even Jill. I wouldn't even say a word of it to Champ. There was nothing embarrassing about getting older, but I wasn't having it. Had Finn been on his way to see me? Did he think I could offer him protection? What could I do that the police couldn't? I hadn't been able to prevent his death. I wasn't the vice president anymore. I didn't have any formal authority. I was just an old man. I couldn't keep pace with the shady characters I'd encountered so far, either physically or mentally. And with my banged-up knee, I didn't have a snowball's chance in heck of running from them if they turned the tables and started pursuing us. I wasn't the same man Finn had known all those years ago. The man Finn had known was a decade younger. The man Finn had known hadn't spent 8 years fighting Tea Party maniacs hell-bent on obstructionism. Barack's hair had gone gray. Mine was already white when we started. It was madness to think I could help Finn. But I wasn't sure I had much choice. Finn needed me. His family needed me. But first, I needed sleep. I flicked the light switch off and returned to the motel bedroom. I would shower in the morning. "Everything come out okay, Joe?" Barack asked. "Just fine," I said. Barack liked to rib me about my age, mostly in the form of jokes. "Are you getting enough fiber, Joe? How's your prostate, Joe?" That sort of thing. Barack did that to everyone, though. He liked to joke with his close friends and aides, when in reality he was putting all of us down. It had never really bothered me. I like to think of myself as good-humored by nature. But today I wasn't in the mood. I glared at Barack, warning him that he should back off or get socked. I hadn't socked someone in almost 70 years. I was sort of looking forward to it. I fell onto the bed without pulling back the bedspread. The mattress was hard and unforgiving. The pillow felt like it was filled with wet sand. While Barack showered, I picked up the TV remote and realized the room was missing a television. There were some wires and cables poking out of the wall where a TV had once been mounted. When Barack returned, he was dressed in a T-shirt and gym shorts. Barack hadn't let himself go to the birds. I'd already known this, having watched several of his little adventure videos. He was all muscle and bone. He gave new meaning to the phrase dad bod. I realized I was staring and quickly looked away. "Are you going to make room for me?" Barack asked. I inched over to one side, leaving him half the bed, which wasn't much. My left arm dangled over the edge and touched the floor. Barack slid in next to me. "I called the front desk, but they didn't have a spare mattress. Unless you want to wait for another room, this is it. Did they say what happened to the other one?" "You don't want to know," Barack said. "You really don't want to know." He turned off the bedside lamp. We lay in the dark, side by side, each of us half off the bed, staring at the ceiling. We could hear the steady, gentle thumping of a bed frame knocking against the wall in the room next door. After a few minutes, the bed frame went silent. A woman cried out in ecstasy. Barack and I started giggling like a couple of kids. When we caught our breath, I was too worked up to sleep. "POTUS, SCOTUS, or FLOTUS," I said. Barack turned to me. "What's that?" "It's a game we used to play in the Senate while we were waiting out overnight filibusters. I name three women, and you say who you'd like as your POTUS, SCOTUS, or FLOTUS. You got it. So give me the names. Nancy Pelosi, Elizabeth Warren, and Hillary Clinton." There was a long pause. "Give me three different names," Barack said. "Sorry, I can't change the rules. It's a little demeaning to women. Who came up with this game? Strom Thurmond? Hey now, Strom may not have been Pope Francis, but he wasn't sexist. He was racist, Joe. The correct term is segregationist." "Oh," Barack said, staring at the ceiling. "That's so much better. You're avoiding the question. POTUS, SCOTUS, or FLOTUS. Nancy Pelosi, Elizabeth, Hillary for POTUS, Elizabeth for SCOTUS, Nancy for FLOTUS. I stared at him, incredulous. Nancy for FLOTUS? Not Elizabeth Warren? You're insane. Elizabeth Warren is the youngest of the three. That's why I'd seat her on the Supreme Court. You know age was the primary reason they tapped Gorsuch. Fine, but Hillary is POTUS? You're joking, right? Are you still bitter about the whole election? I could have beat that short-fingered clown in the General Barack. I could have... Good night, Joe. I sighed. Good night, Barack. I closed my eyes and tried to sleep, but couldn't get Hillary's face out of my head. I knew the direction the country had taken wasn't her fault. I also knew that if I'd run, I would be sleeping in the White House instead of the Heart of Wilmington Hotel. I cracked an eye and saw that Barack was still awake, staring at the ceiling. I finally looked up, too, and saw that he was watching a cockroach run back and forth, like a swimmer doing laps in a pool. "You ever think about running again?" I asked him. "For president?" "For anything," I said. "Senate. Michelle would kill me in my sleep." "Be serious." "I am," Barack said. "She said she'd smother me with a pillow. Even showed me which one she'd use." "Fine," I said, "but you still didn't answer me. You ever think about it? Forget if you'd actually do it. You have to think about it sometimes." "I think about a lot of things," Barack said. "I don't like to talk about them." "Bad thoughts?" "Bad thoughts, good thoughts." "You see a shrink? You think I need to?" I snorted. "I'm a man, Joe," Barack said. "Sometimes a man has thoughts that he shouldn't. Or let me rephrase that. A lot of times a man has thoughts that he shouldn't. You can't control your thoughts. You can only control your actions." He paused. "You're thinking about running, aren't you?" "I think about a lot of things, too. But, yeah, that's one of them." "What does your heart tell you?" "That I was put on this earth to serve, and by God, that's what I've done. The question is, when is it enough?" Barack took a deep breath, then exhaled. "It's never enough. I'd give away every dollar I have, and I practically do some years, to fix what's wrong with our country, to fix what's wrong with the world. But like you said, it's never enough," I said. "So why do we keep doing it?" "To make a difference," Barack said. "And have we made a difference?" "Yeah," I said. "Have we made a difference?" He closed his eyes. "I don't know, Joe. I just don't know." Chapter 20. The next morning I woke from my deepest sleep in a long time. I felt like a much younger man, reinvigorated. I stretched my arms wide and found the other side of the bed empty. "Rise and shine, sleepyhead," Barack said. He was buttoning his suit jacket in front of the full-length mirror on the back of the bathroom door. One button, then two, then one again. His suit, the same one he'd worn yesterday, a Martin Greenfield, looked cleaned and pressed. Barack must have noticed my shocked expression. "There's a laundry service next door. Had them freshen my joint up. I wasn't going to walk around with hash brown chunks on my lapels. Your clothes are on the chair." I wiped the cobwebs from my eyes and sat up. "Why didn't you wake me? When's checkout?" Barack raised his palms. "Relax, Joe. We have plenty of time. It's not even 10. I rolled out of bed. Immediately my knee buckled under me, and Barack rushed to steady me. "I'm okay," I said, a lie if either of us had ever heard one. I held myself up with a hand on the chair. "We don't have time to lollygag around. A man's reputation is on the line," Barack said. His voice was cool, calm, collected, vintage Barack Obama. Meanwhile, I was panicked and blustering, vintage Joe Biden. I sighed. We were falling back into our old familiar ways. "What's the plan?" I asked, getting dressed. Barack narrowed his eyes. "The plan?" "For breakfast," I said. "There's no continental breakfast, if that's what you're asking." I checked my phone. There was a missed call at 2 in the morning from a 302 area code. Esposito's home number, possibly? I dialed it back. The phone rang and rang, but never went to voicemail. Damn it! It was a little early in the morning for curse words, but these were extraordinary circumstances. "I assume Steve called you. How's he taking things?" "Pretty well, all things considered. He did lose the 44th President of the United States. That reminds me, I need to call Jill and let her know I'm not lying dead in a ditch somewhere. One presumes that would have made national news, Barack said. Oh, don't give me that. You've already talked to Michelle, haven't you? I texted her last night. I told her I was staying at your place. She thinks we're having a sleepover. As long as she doesn't talk to Jill, we're okay. I groaned. You want me to tell Jill I stayed the night at your place? What the wives don't know won't hurt them. And as long as we keep our stories straight and don't get caught, our wives won't hurt us. My stomach growled. Either I was hungry again, or my body just couldn't take any more stress. Jill and I had a fabulous relationship, but it was a relationship built on trust. I was about to break her trust. I knew it was for the greater good, but it still made me queasy. I called her. At first I thought I'd gotten a reprieve, as the phone rang four times without an answer. But no, just before it should have gone to voicemail, she picked up. I was out gardening, she said. What did you want? She should have been frantic with worry, but her voice was surprisingly calm. If anything, she was maybe a little irritated, as if she thought she'd finally gotten me out of the house, and now I wasn't willing to leave her alone. I stayed at Barack's last night, I said. He was in town for the funeral, and we went back to D.C. for a nightcap, stayed up late talking about old times, the usual stuff that guys do. Oh, she said, what's their guest room like? I had no idea what his guest room looked like. Not only that, but I had no idea what the inside of his kitchen or living room or any other part of his D.C. house looked like. I only had the vaguest notion, really, of what neighborhood the Obamas lived in. I stayed with Barack in the master bedroom, I said. Michelle was out of town, and Barack didn't want to sleep alone. Jill laughed on the other end. I'm sure you did. She paused. Did you need something? I was worried that you'd be worried. If you were lying dead in a ditch somewhere, I'm sure I'd have heard about it by now, she said. It'd be all over CNN. Barack was sitting on the edge of the bed with a smirk when I hung up. What? I said. I didn't say anything. I undid the chain lock on the door and looked over my shoulder. I had my wallet, I had my phone, whatever else I left behind the maid could keep. If there was a maid. Where are we headed? Barack asked. First to the nearest fast food joint for breakfast, and then... Well, I haven't thought that far in advance. As long as they have green tea, I'm fine with wherever. I opened the door. The sunlight blinded me at first, and I covered my eyes with my hands. I'd forgotten my Ray-Bans. If I remembered right, they were on the bathroom sink. However, I didn't need to see what was in front of me to know what was there. I heard it, the unmistakable filling-rattling growl of a 1,500-horsepower engine. The little beast. Barack handed me my sunglasses. With my eyes shielded, I could see the 5'8" figure standing beside the open back door, his mirrored shades reflecting as much sunlight as the metallic hood ornament. His face was as stoic as ever. "Who's hungry?" Steve asked. Chapter 21 We were sitting in the McDonald's parking lot when my phone rang. It was the 302 number again. "This is Joe. Who's this?"
"It's the mayor. I'm at a payphone, so I don't have much time. I didn't want to say too much yesterday because you never know who's listening. You dig me?"
"Yeah," I said, stepping out of the car to take the call. I needed to walk off the two Egg McMuffins I'd obliterated.
"I told you about our card games, but what I didn't tell you was that Finn had stopped coming to them. I think he knew that we knew he'd become mixed up in something bad."
"Drugs?"
"I don't know the specifics. He kept quiet about it, but we could all tell he was hiding something. At first we thought it might have something to do with his wife down at Baptist Manor, because he never said a word about her being sick, even though we all knew it. But it wasn't that. Like I said, we didn't have any idea of what exactly he'd become mixed up in. What we did know was that it was nothing good. The last time he was over for cards, we got a look at the inside of his wallet. We're not high stakes. When he pulled a few bills out, though, we all saw the cash he was sitting on."
"You're saying he was loaded?"
"Like a mother," the mayor said. "Maybe he just cashed out his savings, or something else. None of us said a word then, but later on we talked. Alvin swore he didn't know nothing."
"Alvin Harrison?"
"His engineer, yeah. Anyway, Finn had too much cash for somebody in his situation, with a sick wife and a daughter in school. Maybe if he worked in a cash business like I do, it would make sense. Maybe. But later on, when I went to use one of the tens I'd won that night, I noticed something about it. It was dirty. All cash is dirty, I said. In fact, I once read that 90% of all U.S. currency tested positive for cocaine. You don't want to know how much tests positive for fecal matter. I don't just mean dirty. I mean dirty. There was a tiny highlighter mark in the corner of the bill. It had been marked by a cop or the FBI. I wouldn't bet my life on it, but I'm pretty sure it was drug money. You think he was on heroin? I asked. If you're getting high, the cash always flows out of your wallet, not the other way around. Plus, I've seen enough people doped up in my time to know what it looks like. You can't hide that faraway look in your eyes. Have you told the police any of this? The laugh at the other end was so loud and shrill, I had to hold my phone away from my ear. Stop by next time you're in the station, he said, but don't mention this conversation because it never happened. It wasn't until I'd hung up that something hit me. Something the mayor said. Alvin Harrison, his engineer. His engineer. Of course. Alvin was the engineer Finn worked in tandem with on the 7:46 a.m. Acela Express. I knew he'd been driving the train that hit Finn, but hadn't put two and two together. I should have realized earlier that he was also the same engineer who'd worked beside Finn every day. No wonder he was so shaken by the accident. Finn hadn't just been a co-worker. Finn had been Alvin's closest co-worker. I returned to the back seat and told Barack what I'd learned from the mayor. Barack listened from the front passenger seat, watching me in the rear view. He was on his third package of apple slices, which were the only things on the McDonald's menu he'd found acceptable. Steve pretended not to listen to us, but I could tell he was interested. He'd been surprisingly nonchalant about our ditching him last night. We all agreed to let bygones be bygones. There was too much on the line for personal feelings to get in the way. I didn't have Alvin's phone number, but I didn't need it. I knew where he lived because Gran and I had dropped him off at his apartment. Start the car, I told Steve. We need to talk to the engineer. Barack craned around to see if I was serious. You sure we shouldn't wait for Esposito? The cops and the transportation board have raked this guy's chestnuts over the open fire. But if there's even the slightest chance he's holding something back, who's he going to talk to? Another cop or Amtrak Joe? You make an excellent point. Maybe they haven't asked the right questions. He knows something. He has to. Two men work that closely for that long, they're bound to open up to each other. They're bound to forge a close bond. Hey, Steve, that sounds like us, right? Barack said, patting Steve on the back. Steve started the car. I leaned back in my seat and closed my eyes. We started backing up, then abruptly stopped. We have company, Barack said. I opened my eyes. Red and blue lights were flashing in the rearview mirror. A police car was blocking our exit. On either side of us were more police cars. We were boxed in. Nobody has anything illegal, do they? I asked. No guns, no... We're clean, Barack said. No marijuana, cigarettes... I know that stuff is legal in D.C. now, but this isn't D.C. They're called joints, Joe, Barack said. And no, I don't have any on me. I left all my pot back in my man cave. Before I could ask if he was kidding, he'd never said a word about having a man cave before, there was a tap on Steve's window. It was Esposito. She wasn't smiling. Chapter 22 Steve rolled down his window, but he didn't say a word. His hands were at 10 and 2 on the wheel, just like we all learned in driver's ed. Esposito glanced at the well-dressed man in the passenger seat. Her eyes went wide when she realized this was Barack Hussein Obama, but she quickly regained her cool. She spied me in the back. So it's true, huh? Y'all really are best friends. Something like that, I said. Barack glanced in the mirror at me. It looked like he wanted to say something, but it wasn't the time or the place. I cleared my throat. We're on our way to the golf course. Esposito scanned the endless blue sky. Supposed to be a storm coming. They say you're more likely to hit a hole-in-one than get hit by lightning. I don't play golf, so I wouldn't know, she said, shifting her belt. But I'm not here to talk sports. She rested a forearm on the open window and leaned in,
encroaching on Steve's personal space. He didn't flinch.
You guys know that I put my best detectives on Mr. Donnelly's case at great cost to the city, I should add. We're under siege. We don't have the manpower to assign detectives willy-nilly, but apparently that's not enough, because I get a voicemail last night saying we need to talk. A voicemail that says you found something. You're damn right we need to talk. Well, I stammered, the motel where he was staying, what did you find? There's a section of carpet missing in his room. Someone ripped it up, but there's a bloodstain on the floor underneath. Thought you could send someone over to test it. A bloodstain. And his car is still there. She crossed her arms. And what did you find in his car? Another bloodstain? I started to sputter something about styrofoam cups, but she cut me off. I'll tell you what you found. Nothing. It's the same thing we found. And you know why we found nothing? Because there's nothing to find. One of my detectives noticed the missing carpet, called out forensics. Whatever the stain was, we'll never know. It was treated with oxygen bleach. Now, before you run with that, we checked the housekeeping supply closet and found gallons of oxygen bleach. Somebody made a mess, somebody else cleaned it up. Nobody that worked there knew how long the carpet had been ripped up, even. It's not enough to build a case on. But when you consider the break-in at Finn's home, she cut me off. We apprehended the burglars responsible, the ones who hit up homes while people were away at funerals. They're a couple of real lowlifes. Did they confess? They will. We're still building our case. In the meantime, they're not going anywhere. She shifted her belt. Listen, I understand if you're still spooked by the map with the address on it, but unless your buddies at the Secret Service have any evidence they're withholding from us, the case is all but closed. What happens if the toxicology results show he wasn't on drugs? Then he had a heart attack or a stroke. Perhaps he took his own life. Unless somebody steps forward with a first-hand account of his final hours, we may never know why he was out there and what really happened. She paused, then added, I've seen this 1,000 times. Mysterious deaths? She shook her head. This! What you're doing! You're trying to piece together meaning from randomness. It's a path with no end. You're going down a dark road. I've seen families spend years and years looking for meaning in a loved one's death. They get the idea from TV shows that every death is a crime, and that crimes are solved over the course of an hour with commercial breaks in between. That's not real life. This is. I hear what you're saying, but it's better if we all move on, she said, for you and Finn's family. Enjoy the day. Maybe you can get a few holes in before the rain begins. We'll try. I croaked. After the cops left, I turned to Barack. You have a man cave? Barack rolled his eyes. Boy, you weren't kidding about her. What's her deal? She's a Republican. Seriously. I get the feeling she's trying to divert us for some other reason, that she knows more than she's telling us, and maybe covering something up. That's a possibility, Barack said. The other angle is that she's being straight with us, that she has seen friends and family get obsessed with cases before and refuse to let go. If she knew what we knew, you could have told her about the woman in the motel room, Barack said. You didn't. You could have mentioned the duffel bag. You didn't. We never found a shred of evidence to directly tie the woman to Finn, and the duffel bag, I'm not sure it would matter. Esposito has her mind made up. All the evidence in the world won't be enough to get her off her ass. Dan has probably been reassigned to traffic control for a few weeks. And if he's not, I'm not sure if he'll risk his job to help me again. And I wouldn't ask him to either. Barack didn't dispute this. I knew he'd already come to the same conclusions. I have a bad feeling about all of this, I said. You didn't before? Steve asked. Nobody asked you, I snipped. Barack folded the newspaper he'd been skimming. Step back and look at what we have so far, Joe. Nothing we've found even remotely ties together. I can see that. I think you can, too. What if Esposito was right? What if we're just trying to piece together a bunch of random events? The reason we haven't found anything to tie them together could be because they don't tie together. There's no hard evidence because there isn't some vast conspiracy. People don't just die for no reason. I'm not saying they do, Barack said. I'm just saying we may be trying to assign meaning where meaning doesn't exist. If we wait for the toxicology results to be returned, we may have a better picture of what happened. If we wait that long, this thing will have blown up in the papers. Somebody's bound to leak the details, the map, the heroin. They will, Barack said, but it will blow over.
The news cycle is getting shorter and shorter. There are plenty of more important things going on. People will talk, and then they'll forget about it 24 hours later. I stared sharp daggers at him. For me, this is the most important thing going on.